Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. The Earth Summit has concluded amid rave reviews and those simply raving. What is the New World Order? Who will benefit and who will pay? Dr. Jay Hare of the National Wildlife Federation speaks from Rio. Also this time, the endangered Gunnison River in Colorado, a scenic river or an economic workhorse. And we'll visit Joan Snyder on her sheep dairy farm, from where she says, we are expanding our concept of what healthy food means.
People are beginning to say, well, wait a minute, if it's not good for me, perhaps it isn't good for the earth, perhaps it isn't good for the animals. So I think it's radiating out in circles that benefit all of us in terms of long-term agricultural issues and land use.
The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. The meeting is over. The United Nations Conference on the Environment and Development, held in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, has concluded. Now the question is, just what was accomplished? Whereas the first such environmental meeting, in Stockholm in 1972, was attended by 30 or so nations, the 1992 Earth Summit drew nearly 200 heads of state and thousands of other attendees, 35,000 in all. Millions of dollars were spent on the event. Billions more are pledged toward future environmental protection. But in the end, what does it all mean? The summit was 2.5 years in the planning. No doubt we have another 2.5 years at least of analysis. A few days before the meeting broke up, Dr. Jay Hare, president of the National Wildlife Federation, held a press conference, speaking to reporters by satellite from Rio. Dr. Hare opened the conference with a brief statement.
It's a rainy day here, and I'm delighted to have a chance to summarize some of the important events that are happening at the Earth Summit. Let me start by saying that the Earth Summit, the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development, in my opinion, is the most important meeting ever convened in the history of humankind. Regretfully, though, President Bush and the White House are treating it like a sideshow at a circus. The dream that was the Earth Summit has hit the reality of Rio, and no one except the Bush administration can be blamed for its failure to achieve all that it could have been.
Hare was asked whether he felt the summit was, as a whole, a success or a failure, and if it was a failure, how are we to proceed now?
Well, clearly the Earth Summit is not a failure. It's a very serious disappointment in President Bush and the United States' failure to provide leadership. But the Earth Summit is where the new world environmental order really began. This is the place where the world, not the United States, is saying there is no such thing as traditional superpower. We must develop new ways of having partnering relationships, because when it comes to sustainable development, environmental protection, there is no us and them. It's only us. And the way that's going to happen, the way that dream is going to become a reality, is when each and every individual in the developed and the developing world commits themselves to the achievement of global economic and environmental sustainability. They are the twin goals of the future. They're inextricably linked. And that begins with each and every one of us. And that's the hope, because now we, for the first time, have brought the world's community of non-governmental organizations together, and they now have a network that has never been in place before. That's not going to change. That's only going to improve. With Great Britain's commitment to reconvene an NGO forum in England in 1993, with a commitment to have a major commission on sustainable development at the United Nations, those are all very significant positives. The negative is, and the sadness is, that there was so much more could have been achieved at this unique time. President Bush and his administration simply failed to do that. That's a tragedy for America. It's a tragedy for the world. But we shouldn't let their failures dampen our enthusiasm as individuals to get involved.
There were two major conventions or treaties signed, the Biodiversity Convention, a legally binding treaty requiring nations to protect endangered species and prepare a detailed study of their plant and animal kingdoms. The United States did not sign this treaty. The other major treaty was the Global Warming Convention, Though legally binding, it does not require nations to cut back on so-called greenhouse gas emissions. Rather, there is only a recommendation to do so. Furthermore, at the insistence of the U.S. delegation, the convention does not set any timetables by which such reductions would be achieved. With these modifications, the U.S. did sign the convention. Also accepted at the summit was a nearly 1,000-page document called Agenda 21. Well, in the weeks and months leading to the summit, and certainly at the summit itself, the question of how to pay for environmental protection worldwide was widely debated. The United Nations has proposed each wealthy nation contribute 0.7% of its gross national product in economic aid to poorer nations. The $6 to $7 billion pledged so far does not come close to paying for cleanup costs worldwide, which, some analysts say, could cost as much as $125 billion a year, each year, for the rest of the decade. The United States was nearly alone in opposing massive increases in aid, citing the difficulty of monitoring how that money would be spent. I asked Hare whether environmental protection is a money issue or a question of attitude.
Yes, it is more than money. It is that attitudinal change. But I think the developing world understands for the first time that much of the world's financial capacity, which has historically gone to creating a false sense of national security through the production of military armament and might, now has an opportunity to be reallocated. And I think there is a real growing sense of the importance of the United Nations as a body. We saw it first being enacted in the Persian Gulf War and rallying the world's nations towards that particular initiative. They're also sensing that there may now be an opportunity to do that to fight the ultimate battle of the world, and that's to save the Earth. However, let me go back to the Bush administration. Yes, the United States does provide leadership in a number of areas, but we damn well should. We also pollute more than any other country in the world. And quite frankly, it rings a little hollow when the United States is pointing its fingers at countries like Brazil to implement a forestry convention, but we have systematically destroyed and mined the ancient forests of the Pacific Northwest. We are, as a nation, destroying critical habitat for the protection of endangered species. It rings a little hollow when President Bush and his administration says that we're doing wonderful things in the United States to conserve biological diversity. Proof is just simply not there in many cases.
Hare concluded his conference from Rio with this reminder.
The National Wildlife Federation has this slogan, Earth Day, every day, you can make a world of difference. I've twisted that a little bit to say Earth Day, every day, we can make a different world. And that's the challenge coming out of Rio. That's the road from Rio, is how do we take the people, the individuals, those who really do understand the link between environmental protection and economic development and a sustainable future, getting those people to take actions to truly make a difference. I'm very optimistic that people will do that.
Dr. Jay Hare, president of the National Wildlife Federation, speaking to us by satellite from Rio de Janeiro. British Prime Minister John Major has called for a reconvening of non-governmental organizations to meet in Great Britain in June of 1993. Stay tuned for more reports on the Rio summit next time. This is Bruce Robertson. Now that the Earth Summit has concluded, with treaties signed and money spent, the question could be asked, so what? Well, here were some thoughts is environmental writer Joel McCower.
In some ways, the Earth Summit is a distraction, a smokescreen of sorts, diverting us from the daily environmental problems that face nearly every community. It's here, on the local level, not in Brazil, that the solutions will have to take place, where the inspiration and ingenuity will inevitably need to originate if anything substantive is going to be done. The Earth Summit makes for a seemingly frustrating paradox. It's a dramatic demonstration of international leadership on environmental matters, but the actual solutions have to come from each of us at home. But that's exactly how it should be. Even the greenest of world leaders can only do so much. With luck, a good leader provides inspiration and empowerment. They create a future by showing us what we must learn, not by reinforcing what we already know. They can't recycle our discards, change our driving habits, or oversee our birth control methods. They can only offer a vision, and we must do the rest. It's been said that to be a good leader, you must also be a good follower. You must tap into the grassroots ideas and innovations, providing nurturing and support and helping those ideas to flourish. These so-called leader followers view their constituencies not as a group of people to be governed, but a series of collective visions, each needing a driving force in order to come to pass. Good leaders become that driving force. In most countries, including the United States, that vision and inspiration remains sadly lacking. Our leaders are, by and large, timid on the environment, shrinking from the challenges rather than embracing them. They seem to fear the future and the changes that must inevitably come if individuals and businesses are to create the kind of sustainable future that is a central theme at Earth Summit. In fact, that's the real lesson of Earth Summit. Don't count on all these self-celebrated world leaders to solve our environmental problems for us. We must do it ourselves, day by day, one small change at a time. For us to be the masters of our own fate, we must find ways in our own homes and communities to make a difference. That's what we need to get us out of this mess, not globally televised speeches, not photo opportunities on the campaign trail, not brave new buzzwords like sustainable development, not more bigwigs sitting around talking. What we need is to act, and each of us must do our part, at home, at work, in the marketplace, and at the voting booth, because no one else is going to do it for us. Remember that classic Earth Day slogan, think globally, act locally? It still makes sense, now more than ever.
Joel McCower, co-author of the popular book, The Green Consumer, and author of the recent book, The Green Commuter, and editor of the monthly Green Consumer Letter. He is also president of Tilden Press in Washington, D.C. This is Bruce Robertson. Some call Western Colorado's Gunnison River one of America's 10 most endangered rivers. A number of different interests want the river's water for agriculture, hydropower, distant cities, and recreation. Others want to protect the Gunnison and its spectacular Black Canyon from further development. For more than a decade now, local and environmental groups have been working to gain wild and scenic river designation for the Gunnison. As Becky Rumsey reports, two new plans, a congressional bill and a multi-agency water contract, could determine the future of this Western Colorado River.
Most people who see the Black Canyon see it from here, one of the overlooks in the Black Canyon of the Gunnison National Monument. From here, they see the near-vertical, dark-toned rock walls, and 2,000 feet below, the brown thread of the Gunnison.
We've seen a lot of canyons. But that's different. It really is.
We love it. We think it's beautiful.
Oh, it's fabulous. If you're talking about right out here, fabulous, just fabulous.
The Black Canyon is the work of the Gunnison River. Over the course of 2 million years, it cut down through an ancient mound of crystalline rock. Downstream from the monument, the canyon opens up into a Bureau of Land Management area known as the Gunnison Gorge. Here, ouzels, birds known as dippers, feed in the same waters that host a gold medal trout fishery. Altogether, 26 miles of the Gunnison flowing through the monument and the lower gorge are eligible for wild and scenic designation. But in 12 years, several attempts to gain that designation have failed in Congress.
I think they were done a little bit hastily without all the input necessary to make a good bill that is acceptable to everybody.
Fred Wetlaufer is a member of Western Colorado Congress. The Montrose-based environmental group supports a new bill introduced by Congressman Ben Nighthorse Campbell. The bill's a package deal. It designates a wild and scenic river and a wilderness area in the lower gorge. It maintains multiple use in BLM lands surrounding the gorge. And for businesses that want to boost tourism, it renames the National Monument as a national park. Campbell's bill is the result of over 5 years of negotiations among local groups and federal agencies.
Since that groundwork was done, I think this bill has a much better chance of getting on through with some revisions.
Revisions are what national environmental groups like the Wilderness Society and the Sierra Club want before they'll support the bill. Sierra Club spokeswoman Tina Arapkalis says the bill would set a dangerous national precedent.
It doesn't really do what it sets out to do. It talks about the Magnificent Canyon, and it sets aside all this land and designates a wild scenic river, but it denies the protection for the water that has created each of those spectacular resources.
Wetlaufer says a federal water right with a 1992 priority date would be toothless in Colorado.
These contract negotiations, on the other hand, are dealing with a water right that has a 1933 priority date, the same as the designation of the National Monument. And that carries some weight in Colorado.
Proponents of Campbell's bill are counting on a contract negotiation beginning this summer. The U.S. Bureau of Reclamation plans to design a water agreement with the National Park Service, the BLM, and the Colorado Water Conservation Board. It's an ambitious undertaking that evolved partly because no one has determined how much water the Black Canyon is actually entitled to under its 1933 federal water right. That issue could be mired in Colorado water courts for years. In the meantime, additional proposals to divert the Gunnison's water spurred the agencies to come up with a plan that would balance environmental protection of the Gunnison with a multitude of competing interests. Steve McCall is an environmental officer with the Bureau of Reclamation.
This particular contract is, fairly unique.
The contract process could take 3 to 5 years. Even so, citizens groups and the agencies say it's the best short-term route towards protecting the 26 canyon miles of the Gunnison. The contract will go forward with or without Congressman Campbell's Wild and Scenic Bill, but if the bill passes, it could add congressional weight to environmental protection in the contract negotiations. For the High Plains News Service, I'm Becky Rumsey.
The High Plains News Service is a production of the Western Organization of Resource Councils in Billings, Montana. Questions about the long-term effects of chemical fertilizers increasingly are being asked. For one organic farmer, though, there is no question. Kathy Ray visited with dairy sheep farmer Joan Snyder, who sees a vital and exciting connection between organic farming and health. Not just for human beings, but for the land as well.
The first sheep I ever saw was at the Columbia County Fair. And they were so beautiful, and they were all fluffy and white and everything. I didn't realize that those were sheep that had sort of, you know, special grooming for the event.
Joan Snyder's perception of sheep has completely changed since then. A former investment banker in New York City, Snyder turned her weekend retreat into her full-time livelihood 3 years ago. She now runs a sheep dairy farm.
And they are very disappointed that you came empty-handed. Basically, they have nothing to say to you other than, under the model, let me crawl all over you.
The lambs crowd around, nibbling our pants and fingers, looking for the bottle that usually accompanies anyone who enters the pen. Within the next year, many of them will join the current flock of 300 sheep at Hollow Road Farms in Stuyvesant, New York. While sheep cheeses like Roquefort and Pecorino Romano are common in the U.S., sheep dairies are not. There are perhaps 7 compared to nearly 3,000 in France alone. Snyder's Wheaton Business School education and background in finance support her land and farming ethic.
And you are stewards of the land, and that you're not entitled to sort of farm it to its maximum potential in order to make short-term profits. And that's, I think, an analogy that came from business, which is inappropriate. You know, people can depreciate machines because you can replace them, and that's really, in most cases, a fairly sensible strategy for a corporation that's trying to increase its revenues. It's not a sensible strategy for a farmer because you can't replace the land, and damage done with intensive kinds of farming to create more volume is very damaging.
Snyder understands the economic necessity that compels many farmers to work the land intensively, using pesticides and fertilizers. She doesn't see it as a good long-term investment, however, so at Hollow Road Farms, they raise the animals organically.
Oh, there's no choice. You can't choose chemical farming if you're sane. You know, you just can't. I mean, you look at what's happening. People are sort of focused on rainforest. God, I wish they'd look at the farmland situation. I mean, it is pitiful what's been done in terms of intensive grazing. You ruin the land. You just ruin the land. And every year you require more chemicals. And it's a very simple cost equation, you know, from a farmer's point of view, because if he finds that his yields are going down, he adds more chemical. And now what he's figured out is that his chemical bill is probably bigger than every other bill he has in the farm. And farmers are really becoming very aware of that. If you're a consumer, you know, it's very hard for consumers to say, well, I'm in favor of sustainable or organic agriculture, and then do anything about it because they don't have, I mean, it's not exactly an issue that you vote over. Everybody is trying to make a decent living, and if you're a farmer and think, well, I can make more by turning out more product, you obviously try and find the way that works. And what everybody's realizing now, both consumers and farmers, is that that's fine for the short term, but it's not for the long term. And it turns out that the long term is here now, and that what we've done over the last 20 years has been to sort of increase yields at the expense of the land itself, which is not inexhaustible.
Another ethic on which they base their farming practices is that big is not necessarily better. Small farms, however, have difficulty getting into a wide distribution network. To make small more economically feasible for herself and others like her, she and farm co-owner Ken Kleinpeter created a subsidiary distribution company called the American Family Farm. Their two refrigerator trucks deliver sheep cheeses and yogurts, cow's milk, eggs, meat, and seasonal produce directly to New York City's specialty stores and restaurants. Perry Alley and Sign of the Dove are among them. They also drop off orders to the homes of about 60 individuals. The service provides more than just convenience.
They love the connection to the farmer more than anything. They love knowing where their food came from. Someone called and said, well, how are the chickens slaughtered? I want to make sure. And we said, well, here's the name of the farmer. Call her.
Sheep's milk is higher in fat than cow's milk. Its calcium and protein levels also measure higher, though, and it can be consumed by many people who can't tolerate cow's milk. Snyder feels that a concern for the origins of our food reflects larger definitions of the concept of health.
I think people are much more conscious of how they eat from a health perspective now. And I think that health, blissfully, has finally turned out to be something other than fat. I mean, concerned about how much fat you're eating, which isn't obviously very good for you, but that was a single focus obsession for a long time. Now people, I think, are moving away from that, saying, well, wait a minute, health means how it was grown, as well as, you know, how much fat or what the nutritional components are. And from that, people are beginning to say, well, wait a minute, if it's not good for me, perhaps it isn't good for the earth, perhaps it isn't good for the animals. So I think it's radiating out in circles that benefit all of us in terms of long-term agricultural issues and land use.
Joan Snyder, co-owner of Hollow Road Farms Sheep Dairy in Stuyvesant, New York. With their recently awarded USDA grant, they'll be exploring such issues. They'll also continue to breed dairy sheep, which, under current regulations, can't be imported from Europe and the Middle East. Despite its relative obscurity right now, Snyder sees a future in the sheep dairy industry. Despite the difficulties for farmers, she also sees a future for farming.
Is it something that you think you'll do until you're 60 or 70 years old?
90, I would have thought, until I'm 90.
At Hollow Road Farms, this is Kathy Ray.
Oh, come here.
Well, that's our report on The Environment Show this week. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. If you know of something happening in your area that you think we ought to know about, or if you have a question about this week's or any week's Environment Show, do drop us a line. Address your questions and your comments to The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show number 129. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer, and this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.